number 10-1392, Old Front Mining Company petitioner versus Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission et al. Mr. Moore, petitioner, and Mr. Moore for response.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm R. Henry Moore, and I represent Wolf Run Mining Company here. What we have before you is sort of a unique rule. It's a inspector-issued safeguard issued at individual mines, and it is different than mandatory health and safety standards which are promulgated through notice and comment rulemaking. It is frankly different from regulations, and it is different from mine plans, which are the subject of extensive negotiation and are done at a higher level than the inspector level. We would not be here if the safeguard hadn't been issued at the Sentinel Mine. That's the fundamental issue we have here. There is no violation of anything unless that safeguard is issued and unless there's a failure to comply with the safeguard. Now, the commission relied on Section 314B of the Act, which grants authority, as I see it, to issue safeguards to individual inspectors. The commission interprets it to be a requirement for an operator to comply with safeguards. I think in looking at this, we have to bear in mind the fundamental fact that without the safeguard, we aren't here. And I think we also have to look at Section 3, because what the commission did is they said, look, you look at Section 3, and it says interim mandatory safety and health standards. And interims, this goes back to 1969. Interim mandatory health and safety standards are ones established, and that's a key word, I think, established in the other sections, in Part 3 and Part 2. Well, what we have here is we've got nothing in Section 314B. Well,
isn't 314B part of Title 3?
It is part of Title 3, Your
Honor. The statute says that the interim standards established by Titles 2 and 3 are mandatory.
It says
and
that, Your Honor.
That's part of Title 3.
But it doesn't. What we have in Title 3, for example, we have extensive requirements for plans and that sort of thing.
The argument that this isn't a standard somehow?
This is not. A safeguard is not a standard. That's the fundamental thing.
It's a standard as opposed to a safeguard.
What is a standard? A mandatory standard is one, as we see it, that goes through notice and comment rulemaking. Or has some...
Wait a second. But I mean, Sections 2 and Sections 3 provide for the creation of interim mandatory standards, right?
Yes.
But and this came through 314, which is in, I can't remember if it's subsection 2 or 3. So far, not good for you. You've got to then say that this wasn't a standard. It was something other than, and it came through those sections, but it was something other than interim mandatory standard.
It's a
how do you get there?
It derives from 3-4, the authority given to MSHA to issue safeguards. but it is not, in fact, a standard in and of itself.
So what's the difference between a safeguard, which you say is what's going on here, and a standard?
A difference, well, it's, well, I think what we can do is, safeguard, we know an individual inspector goes out and issues it at mine A. He may not issue it at B or C or D.
Specific, right.
They're site-specific, but there aren't really all that much difference between the mines that it requires mine-specific. All right, you've got that. You've got an individual inspector go out. You have a mandatory safety and health standard promulgated under notice and comment rulemaking. Okay, that's not this.
That's right. That's,
that's not this.
One. That's section one.
And the next thing you have are interim standards that Congress developed. Well, Congress didn't develop any individual safeguards,
but
so you don't have that protection.
But in 314B, it says, an authorized representative shall provide safeguards.
Yes.
It says that, right in 314B.
That's what it says. But
and the statute says that anything done under 3 is a mandatory standard. I don't see how you get around. You're reading this as saying... You're saying this, I think, you're reading this to say, you read the statute as saying the interim standards established by Titles 2 and 3, except for Section 314B.
Well,
right? That's
no,
how you read the statute.
No, well,
no.
The way I read the statute, except for the actual safeguards that are developed under 314.
But wasn't it issued by an authorized representative?
It was, in fact, issued by an authorized representative.
Why wasn't that exactly what the statute requires?
I don't think that is a standard established in Titles 2 and 3.
Yeah, except for the fact that the language of 314B says an authorized representative. You'd have a good case if it didn't say that.
Well, I think that essentially tells you that what 314B is, says they can go out and issue the safeguards, but it's really not putting any responsibility on the operator until that safeguard is...
And maybe you answered this and I didn't catch it, and that may be the case, and I apologize. What is the difference between a safeguard and a standard? I mean, the standard, a mine inspector can be a person authorized by the secretary to create an interim mandatory standard under subsections 2 and 3, right? That's possible.
That's where we would disagree with you.
You don't think that's possible?
I think he's got the...
Who are the agents authorized by the secretary to do that?
There are inspectors authorized to issue safeguards. We don't believe that that's an interim mandatory standard.
Who does that then? Who are the folks authorized by the secretary to create interim mandatory standards under 2 and 3?
I don't see...
They don't exist?
The interim mandatory standards are established by Congress. If they're going to do anything new...
The language that says that authorized representatives of the secretary or whatever the agency...
Yes, yes.
Who is that? Who are the...
Those are inspectors. When you become an inspector, you become a designated authorized representative of the secretary.
But you say they cannot issue...
They can issue safeguards, but
not standards.
We do not believe they are interim mandatory standards.
If a safeguard is not a standard, then what does the word other apply to? It says other safeguards adequate. What does other mean?
Well, I think that there is a universe of what other safeguards could be. Okay. But I don't think that...
314B begins with other safeguards adequate.
Yes.
Now, what does other refer to, other than 313, other than 314?
Well, now, I'm not sure what the other means.
Well, doesn't it have to, as you're reading 302 through 318, which are interim mandatory health and safety standards, other refers to those.
Well, no, I don't think it necessarily does.
What does it refer to?
Because it doesn't refer to that whole universe. If anything, it refers only to what's in 314B because that addresses transportation.
Where are the safeguards set out to which other refers?
I haven't given that a lot of thought, Your Honor, but I believe that it is probably limited to what else is in 314.
Well, if that's ambiguous, then And we owe deference to the agency here about how they...
Well, here, if you read it with Section 3, which says interim mandatory standards established, and I think that safeguards, while the concept of safeguards is established in 314B, the actual safeguards themselves are not. Now, I think it's interesting if you look back to the Ziegler-Cole case, which deals with plans and is under the 1969 Act. It is very interesting if you look at Ziegler and you look at the UMWA versus Dole, they didn't rely on Section 3 or interim mandatory standards. They relied on the process. And the process was a negotiated plan that there was give and take back and forth. And they also said, I think it's in footnote 7 in Dole, where they made it clear that what they were talking about if a violation was issued was a violation of the plan, not of what's in Part 3. Because plans are addressed in Sections 302 and Section 303, which obviously are come within that interim mandatory standards that are addressed in Part 3. But if you look at Ziegler and you look at Dole and you look at the implications and you look at the reality of how these are enforced, you have a rule that's being put out there that has could have significant import for the operator, because significant and substantial is a part of elevated enforcement. This also applies to unwarrantable failures. And if you look at that, you say, well, are you comfortable with the fact that we have an inspector-issued rule, and that's what we're using for this elevated enforcement? I would submit that we should not be comfortable that way, that essentially we have here Commissioner Duffy in his dissent repeated to the agency once again, it is time to do rulemaking. Now, when you think of, it's got to be mine specific, they've done rulemaking on transportation and haulage in underground metal, non-metal mines. That's the same agency. And in surface coal mines, that's the same agency, surface metal, non-metal mines. So
in the red brief, 314 is actually set out on at A10.
Mm-hmm.
And you may be right that 314B relates back up to A, which sets out, but I want you to look at how it's styled. Subchapter 3, interim mandatory safety standards for underground coal mines.
Mm-hmm.
Section 874, hoisting and man trips. A, transporting of persons, required equipment and capabilities, safety catches, daily examinations, operators. Then B, promulgation of other safeguards.
Yes.
And then the language about other safeguards adequate. It seems to me that even though the word used is safeguards rather than standards, when you look at the title of subchapter 3, it is interim mandatory safety standards for underground coal mines.
Yes, it is, Your Honor, but the problem is that these, quote, other safeguards are not in here. The authority to deal with them
is the promulgation of them.
It authorizes, not the promulgation, let's not give it more credit.
That's what he says, promulgation of other safeguards.
Yes, but what we have is, in the rulemaking sense, we have one man or one woman going out to a mine and saying, okay, I'm going to issue this safeguard today. And while there are criteria they can follow, they do not have to follow that.
But that can be challenged, right? There's a procedure to challenge the safeguard?
There is no procedure to challenge it until you are cited for a violation.
But it's right in 314B. That's exactly what 314B calls for. It's not as if they've gone beyond the statute.
Well, they haven't gone beyond the statute, but having said that, they are creating rules that you have to comply with.
Which Congress authorized in 314B. It authorized the
they in fact...
authorized representative to issue such other safeguards.
Well,
and it says that anything issued, anything done under Title III is mandatory.
They authorized the concept, Your Honor. They didn't authorize the specific contents of those safeguards. And, well, Your Honor, with all due respect to the United States Congress, they had plenty of other rules they came up with as interim mandatory standards. The fact that they didn't authorize them and they are inspector issued strikes me as a situation where there ought to be a different application here. Because if there isn't, you are permitting an individual inspector to issue a rule.
Now, you can still argue the safeguard itself violates the statute.
That it
goes beyond what's necessary to minimize hazards with respect to transportation. You've got an objective standard there. Congress has imposed a standard, and underground coal mines know that that's the standard. So if they impose a safeguard that violates that standard, you can make your argument. But I don't see how you get beyond the pretty clear language of the statute that Congress has authorized safeguards to be mandatory.
Well, one difficulty you have with that, Your Honor, is, for example, there's a case pending before the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission. Yeah. The safeguard was issued in 1987. Yeah. The litigation started after an accident in 2008. And frankly, there were some changes, but digging up an inspector from 1987 is, shall we say, difficult. The right to challenge is, yes, there is a theoretical right. But the reality is you are potentially subject to enforcement action before you can challenge it. And I will say that I know the secretary will get up and say, well, you can challenge plans too, but there is actually a policy where you can get technical citations that's actually been approved by Congress.
I want to say, I think I agree with the dissent as far as a policy matter. But that's not before us, and you haven't made any challenge to an unlawful delegation of legislative authority, that is.
No, we have not, Your Honor.
That might have worked, I don't know, but we can't really consider what I think Commissioner Duffy when he talked about this is a heck of a way to run a railroad. I mean, you have it on an ad hoc basis, and then you get that significant and substantial.
That was the last case, the real.
Well, actually, if you read, there are two readings of 314B here, and I think there's two readings of Section 3 as to what's meant by established. If you read that as ambiguous, then Commissioner Duffy's discussion actually plays into it, because I think he makes a very good argument that this is not a reasonable interpretation. And it's not reasonable because you do not have the protections normally afforded in creation of rules, even in formal rules such as plans. You actually don't foster mine safety because it's any rule that is arbitrarily applied to one mine and not another isn't doing anybody any good. They've had plenty of time to promulgate rules. I think Commissioner Duffy was right. They ought to do it rather than the way they've done it.
Well, it would promote safety, too.
Yes, it would. That's why it's
safe, had to have the same safeguard.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Lord.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Samuel Charles Lord. I represent the Mine Safety and Health Administration. With me at council table is Chris Schumann. Section 314B is a mandatory safety standard that is enforceable on a mine-by-mine basis through the issuance of a mine-specific notice to provide a transportation-related safeguard. By its plain terms...
I ask you to address your opponent's last point that this just isn't reasonable. That to construe the statute in the way that you're arguing just leads to sort of bizarre results that undermine mine safety. It's not reasonable.
Well, it is a policy choice, as Judge Henderson pointed out, made by Congress and It's one that it's not before this court to second guess. But that said, there are very strong policy reasons for having mine-specific enforcement. Congress, when it enacted the 1977 Act, looked at the experience of, under the Cold Act with mine-specific mine plan provisions. And they specifically approved in legislative history on page 613 the use of these mine-specific regulations and said that this is a way in which a general body universally applicable standards could be augmented and supplemented by mine-specific regulation. And this is one such area where they decided that that was appropriate.
And that includes deputizing or authorizing an inspector in a mine to create a mandatory standard that could lead to forced withdrawal.
Well, it's true. That's Congress.
It's like a pretty big club to give to someone, doesn't it?
The statute does, and Congress did give to an authorized representative of the secretary, and those were the words that they used, the authority to issue a notice to provide safeguard. I think that Wolf Run overstates or understates its ability to gain meaningful review of that safeguard. A safeguard notice, as distinct from a safeguard violation, a violation for failure to provide, a safeguard notice could be immediately reviewable by the commission. The secretary's authorized representative could issue the safeguard. As happens with mine plan disputes, the operator can then say, we will not comply. And a citation will then be issued for failure to provide the appropriate safeguard. And then once that contest proceeding is before the commission, it actually has a wealth of different ways in which it can fight.
On the facts here, wasn't it the case that a certain safeguard was issued? And there was no concern about the safeguard. It made a lot of sense. It was the claim that that safeguard was violated 9 years down the road. How do they contest that in a timely fashion?
They could have contested the issuance of the safeguard notice back in 2000.
No problem with that. Everyone agrees you ought to have something like that. But
okay.
It's the application in this particular instance where a violation is alleged.
They are free to challenge the validity of a safeguard during the contest proceeding after the issuance of the violation 9 years down the road. And there are commission cases where mine operators successfully done that. And there are several different prongs for attack that they can use to try to invalidate a safeguard. They can say, as Judge Tatel suggested, that it went beyond the limited subject area in which Congress authorized this proceeding, and that it's not related to mine transportation. The commission has set up special rules, and the secretary's regulations also indicate that the precise contents of a precise requirements of a mine-specific safeguard have to be set forth with specificity. And if they're not sufficiently specific, then it's an unenforceable safeguard.
Is the dissent wrong? Because on page 13, he says, in stark contrast, a safeguard notice is issued on a random basis by an individual inspector acting unilaterally without provision for secretarial or commission review. The legitimacy of the notice to provide a safeguard and its application to conditions in the mine cannot be determined unless and until the provisions are violated. Is he wrong about that?
It's true that they are only reviewable once a violation has been issued. But as I said before, that can happen immediately after the safeguard notice is issued. This is the same thing that happens with mine plan disputes, the other area where Congress authorized mine-specific regulation in Title III.
So that what this operator would have done, Wolf Run would have said back in, what was it, 2000? I don't agree with you, and I'm not going to put this safeguard in. And that would have taken it up.
Correct.
Well, no, first then he had to issue the citation.
Correct. I think as Judge Tatel indicated before, the use of the term authorized representative of the secretary it shows Congress's intent that this specific area of underground coal mine safety be regulated not just with generally applicable standards, but also supplemental mine-specific regulations. This court's decision in Dole and Ziegler and the legislative history all make clear that mine-specific regulation under Title III is still enforceable as a mandatory standard.
Would it make more sense to make this applicable to all mines? I mean, that's really the point of Commissioner Duffy. He calls it regulatory lassitude, where I guess what he's saying is the commission is using its inspectors to spot these problems in individual mines when the commission itself ought to be saying all mines should have this egress from the conveyor belts or whatever it is, that issue here.
Right. The secretary did promulgate regulations that are generally applicable to underground coal mine safety in 30 CFR 75, the 1400 series. And then we reserved the authority the Congress gave to us to proceed in a mine-specific fashion. I'd also point out that it's recognized in the statute itself and its modifications provision. This is 101C. Congress recognized that there might be some mandatory standards which either could the safety result intended safety result could be achieved in an alternative way, or some standards that if applied across the board could lead to a diminution of safety to mine. So there's a lot of merit in flexibility in tailoring a safety standard to the exact conditions at a particular mine. And mine underground transport and coal mines includes a bunch of different kinds of conveyances and transportation systems.
But isn't it kind of contradictory for the commission to say we're going to let individual inspectors issue these safeguard notices and citations for violations, and at the same time say that that violation can constitute a substantial and significant violation? I mean, if it's that serious a violation, then it ought to be applicable to all mines.
Well, first, it was Congress who gave us this language, not the commission. It was Congress who said that an authorized representative.
But what we're trying to decide is whether that, you're right, whether that counts as whether you can add this additional significant and substantial.
Right. Well, ultimately, it's not that different from a mine plan dispute. Ultimately, the secretary has the authority in a mine plan dispute, a mine-specific mine plan provision, to in essence dictate what the terms of the mine plan will be, subject to review by the commission during contest proceedings. The same applies here with mine transportation safeguard notices.
Do we know whether the inspector just waited 9 years before he went back and discovered this violation, or do we know that Wolf Run had been complying with it all along and then just decided they weren't going to do it anymore?
No, the way we don't know what caused the exact omission of the required crossover in this case, but the way that the standard works, if you look at 75-1403-1, is that after the issuance of a safeguard notice, a mine is required to maintain that safeguard. So Wolf Run may have been maintaining the safeguards as required, the crossovers as required during that period, and then fell out of compliance on this certain date.
I still don't see how that promotes health and safety, because they may have been, if it were a rule that was imposed on all mines, I guess if the inspectors don't make the inspections but every 9 years, they wouldn't have caught that either.
Well, where the Mine Act, of course, has a pretty pervasive scheme of inspections. Mines are underground coal mines are required to be inspected 4 times a year in their entirety. If the court has no further questions, then I'll sit down. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Does Mr. Moore have any time? Why don't you take a couple minutes?
If I may, I would like to address this issue of, well, what happened in the intervening 8 or 9 years. The problem is we have a violation history we can pull off WMSU's website. In this particular case, they cited the criteria rather than 75-1403 or 314B. It's a little bit tough to tell. That's the problem. There's nothing in this record about that. Second of all, in terms of this idea of a technical citation, I'm only aware of one instance in my career, which goes back a number of years, 30 at least, of where there has been a technical citation as such for a safeguard. In most cases, you try to comply, as most operators do, and at some point in the future, something comes up that you're not. And the concept of the technical citation saying this is just like plans ignores the whole plan process and that it's negotiated at a district level, not at the inspector level. And that's why it's different. And the plan process, that technical citation was approved in the 2006 Minor Act, but I would be leery of actually getting a district to issue a, quote, technical citation. It just, that's not the way it works in the real world. If there's nothing else, thank you.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned.